Emery Mort, welcome again to KABU.
Thank you, Bill. It's really nice to be here talking with you.
Last time Emery was on the Old Mole, you were the very model of a movement journalist, a street historian, covering all 9 months near daily at the beginning, but still major protests by Black Lives Matter. Emery Mort's detailed diary, his notes, blog, and video has been invaluable for anybody who wants to know what happened. After a period of decompression, Emery got a paying position as chief of staff for State Representative Teresa Alonzo Leon, who specializes in immigration and education issues. Today, we'll discuss Emery's experience in the 2022 Oregon legislative session, the trials and tribulations of being an Oregon legislator, and we'll also speculate on what sorts of reform are not just palliative to ease the pain, to help people through the country's broken economic and political systems with temporary palliatives, but we'll talk about reforms that show the way to that other, better, democratic, and sustainable world. First, Emery Mort, evaluate the short 2022 session, its accomplishments, and also the disappointments.
Thanks, Bill. I would say the 2022 legislative session, it's a short session in Oregon, you know, every other year is a short legislative session, which is like 5 weeks. And I would say most analysts and participants would say it was a very successful session in terms of quite a lot getting done. The aggressive Republican Party was not able to walk out and shut down the session. And there were many bills that were passed that, you know, it's hard to argue that they weren't at least really attempting in a sincere way to address the major crises going on in the state, from the pandemic, from just an economy and a society that's having a lot of trouble without much of a social net. So I guess in brief, some of the highlights were, you know, the Democrats managed to pass farm worker overtime policy in the state with the backing of just a huge coalition that pushed that across the finish line against intense opposition the entire time. And then there were bills trying to address things like the cost of childcare soaring. There's a bill to send out $600 checks to every Oregonian who earns the earned income tax credit. There's attempts to address serious workforce issues, behavioral health, healthcare, education, where you're having crises of staffing and all of that. And there was also a major change of leadership. Tina Kotek stepped down from her longtime speaker position in the House. Peter Courtney, the Speaker of the Senate, announced this would be his last time. So you had a change of leadership, which is a big deal for people who work in the legislature. But despite all of that, there was a lot of cheering and feeling like folks really worked their butt off and got a lot done, despite also some real glaring holes of things that didn't get done. For example, there's a public defender crisis right now going on in the state, and that wasn't addressed in the state budget, despite having a huge budget surplus to spend. And of course, there are just real problems ahead with lots of people being very housing insecure. There's attempts to address houselessness and get people off the streets, but it's arguable that, you know, a lot of people are going to be ending up on the streets if certain things don't go certain ways. So I'll pause there, but there's just a ton that happened. It's pretty remarkable. But as you said, it's easy to look at it and see a lot of patchwork being done on a kind of a tattered system. But it's also important not to get like too cynical about it all, in my opinion.
Yeah. One final one on my list was the stopping of pretext arrests for minor infractions. That is when the police just stop a car for having a light not working. And then they search the car and search the person and force them to either humiliate themselves or, in fact, risk really serious injury. I think that was the major gain of Black Lives Matter in this legislature. Am I wrong?
Limiting the police's ability to pull someone over for a broken taillight or some other minor infraction like that, that was part of the Transforming Justice bill that did pass, that folks tried to pass last year. I mean, it's definitely a part of the Black Lives Matter push for societal justice. You know, attempting to stop, like, if you're Black, just getting, like, pulled over and harassed all the time by police in a way that white people aren't. And there are other really important components of that bill, too. And so that bill did pass, again, with Republican opposition. You know, Republican, there's a big thing in the state where hyping up this rise of crime and lack of safety, and the Democrats don't support the police, and so crime in the state is rising. You know, this is a big political line, and the Democrats did not cave on that particular issue, held strong, and actually passed the bill. which may make it a challenge for some people running in more purple districts and things like that. We'll see. But there were other important bills, you know, universal representation passed, which provides, it's kind of first in its kind legislation in the country, providing community embedded legal representation to undocumented people, basically immigrants who aren't citizens who often end up in court for different proceedings, but now they will actually have a lawyer who will be able to work with them and give them a sense of dignity through those proceedings. So that passed as well. But I would maybe say Senator Lauren Spence, who folks may know, she helped pass a massive $50 million investment into Black and Indigenous and people of color communities. So that was another major bill that passed as part of the sort of Black Lives Matter movement in terms of like rectifying disinvestment and lack of investment is like getting state investment right into people's hands so that the Black community can economically prosper in a better way. I'm not an expert on that bill and I might have said one or two things wrong, but I just know like that was a really good bill that I think Senator Lauren Spence was spearheading through the Senate.
Yeah, there was a good deal of disappointment also. It's the Black Lives Matter agenda was particularly with regard to the replacement of police by people who are far more qualified and successful in dealing with the homeless and with addiction.
Like Portland Street Response in Portland or counselors and support in schools rather than officers and things like that.
The legislature did not touch that, nor did they touch, my sense is, police discipline, which is such a major thing in Portland, and it's governed by state law, so at least the city says their hands are tied. State law forces a kind of arbitration that the police always win for a variety of reasons when the city pushes more discipline. That seems to me a major loss.
Well, I would say, you know, and this is important to keep in mind is that, I mean, Oregon's one of the most dynamic states in the country politically in a lot of ways. So on the policing discipline and policy side, I would argue that the state of Oregon and the city of Portland did actually manage to accomplish quite a lot. And that's part of how I got really interested in the Oregon legislature is last year watching and participating as Rep. Bynum led committees that were honing police reform packages, of which about 22 statutes managed to pass. And some of those do influence Portland, do influence that arbitration process. And so those can get a bit wonky, all those policies. But obviously, when it comes to policing, like police has a lot of political power and it takes a lot to go up against them and really get significant policy changes. But I would argue that Portland and the state of Oregon and the legislature actually have done quite a lot. It's not enough, but I think folks should feel like this is a state where it's possible to do a lot in that realm, in the realm of police reform or abolitionist type reforms even. And I think even this week, Portland Street Response is set to scale up to citywide, which is, you know, diverting like quite a lot of calls and contact between police and, you know, let's say vulnerable people or whatever. So I would say some of that is actually good. And I would say the Oregon legislature led by, you know, Black legislators like Rep. Bynum actually like stepped up and got a good deal done in that way. But there are other things that like if one talks with Black organizers in Portland or something, there's a lot of sense of a lot of things haven't gotten done or a lot of promises that were made early on in the Black Lives Matter movement like weren't delivered upon by the legislature. So I'm not trying to paint like a rosy picture, but I'm just trying to say from the inside, I do think some things have been done and then some promises or some energies kind of like faded. So some examples would be like Rep. Alonso León was pushing to get ethnic studies funding for professional development in Oregon schools because Oregon passed a law saying, you know, like all students should have ethnic studies like embedded into their curriculum so that they see themselves and their own experience in the curriculum that they're learning in school. But the funding to do the professional development for that, which they're mandated to do that by 2026, so in a couple of years, but the funding just has just kept slipping through the cracks. And that seemed to happen again this year where, oh, we couldn't find the money to fund this ethnic studies program, which is part of Black Lives Matter. It's like teaching all of our history and embedding all that history in our school experience for our kids. Another one is the Racial Justice Youth Collaborative, which is going to be one of its kind in the country, statewide collaborative of youth who meet and talk and organize around racial and social justice in their schools and actually have, like, because youth can be and are very powerful voices for social change and societal change, and they're often, like, not at the table when policies are being changed. And that policy didn't pass this year, and folks are definitely upset about, a lot of folks are really upset about that. So, yeah, it's important, like, a lot of policy did pass and some policy doesn't pass. And we could talk about, like, how all those power structures work and stuff within the legislature. And I'm still getting to know it, but it's very interesting.
Yeah, a few weeks ago, we were talking, and I asked you what it's like for you to have to be up to speed on all the policy issues that come to the legislature. And that's also true for the whole legislature, all representatives. And it's especially tough for legislators when it is a part-time job paying $30,000 a year. No think tank or policy group would dream of asking its very highly educated staff, most people, to be able to have expertise in every issue that comes up. How do individual legislators like Teresa, Alonzo, Leon, how do they make decisions with regard to all of these issues that come before them?
Yeah, absolutely. So folks might have seen some articles and headlines recently about how a number of women legislators from the Democrat side who are chairs of committees, like chair of the House, you know, healthcare committee, you know, folks can imagine like how complex and advanced of a job that is. Well, they're stepping down. They're not coming back to the legislature. Maybe they've been there 4, 5, 6 years. And part of that is because they're paid like $32,000 a year to be legislators. That's what the statute says in Oregon. And if you listen to like Republicans and stuff, well, they'll say that, you know, they've always envisioned that they want the legislature to be like a, they don't want legislators to be full time. You know, they want them to be regular people, and legislation is just a part time thing that you do. But, you know, in reality, especially for women, Democrats who are, you know, Black folks, Indigenous folks, people from immigrant communities, they're in there really, really, really trying to do intense and deep policy change. And like you're saying, they have to be, and they become quite quickly, very expert in what they're doing. They have to understand a lot of complex systems, otherwise they can't move policy. And they're being paid, you know, $32,000 a year to do, yeah, a highly professional work that's really not just part-time, not just full-time, probably like more than full-time in a lot of cases. And in the legislature, I read a fellow staffer in the legislature posted that he heard that in California, state legislators have like 10 staff, like their budget for each office allows them to have like 10 staff. And that is not the case in the Oregon legislature. Like basically each office maybe has one, maybe two full-time staff. And then they bring in some like staff just for the legislative session when things get really busy. All that to say, like it's a lot that's thrown on folks who are trying to, you know, fix just systems that are so maybe dilapidated, like Oregon's mental health system, or, you know, having a system that has justice for immigrants, poor people, Black people. Like there's just a huge amount of repair that needs to be done, or rebuilding, or constructing something anew. So how knowledge, there's knowledge of the policy itself, but then there's also the knowledge of like how the legislature works, like how decisions get made, or how when push comes to shove, like what gets funded or what gets a hearing, what bill gets a hearing, and what bill is just left to die waiting in a committee. And a lot of that knowledge is kind of like passed down orally, like through story and through knowing someone face to face. And so here I am, I come into the legislature, for example, and I'm working remote. You know, normally everyone's in the Capitol, lobbyists are there talking to folks. Hey, can I tell you a little bit about this bill? And they'll show them a one pager, and kind of a lobbyist can be, in a good and bad way, be very expert at just like getting the key information into like a 1 or 2 minute or 5 minute discussion with a legislator or a staffer. And during these last couple of years, legislating has been more done at a distance or remote, over Zoom versus, or over the phone versus face to face. But yeah, to your original question of how expertise, you know, there's like advocate groups, there's people either in industry or in advocacy, or even in a lot of the institutional knowledge can, especially when there's a lot of turnover in the legislature, can end up, the institutional knowledge can be in like staff or lobbyists or stuff, because maybe they've been around 10 or 15, 20 years, because they are getting paid a salary that allows them to like buy a house eventually and have a family. So they'll, so they become people who have a lot of institutional knowledge, which is a problem. And There was a bill this year to raise legislators' salaries, but that bill died for political reasons. It was hard to bring it to the public this year and be like, hey, you're all struggling, but we're going to give ourselves a raise. We're going to vote to give ourselves a raise. Even though that would almost certainly like help the state a lot, it was a hard sell to actual voters who don't take kindly in a sort of like reactive way, to knee-jerk way to that kind of thing. So I'll pause there. I know that was a lot, but those are some of my observations.
Yeah, this notion of citizen legislators in the part-time, just ordinary people. In fact, my sense is because it's so poorly paid and people have to have second jobs or third jobs. In fact, many of the legislators are lawyers who use their position to befriend the various businesses in their area. And they're really not as interested in policy as they are in securing favors from the businesses that are most powerful in their area. It seems to me it's a real problem having a lot of people who cannot live, or you can't raise a family on $32,000, and so you're always caught between your day job and then the legislation.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. This is Bill Resnick for KABU, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM, talking to Emory Moore, street historian, who went to near every action of the Black Lives Matter, George Floyd protests in town. His notes and video are invaluable for anyone who wants to know what happened. Having lobbied and testified before the legislature, he was hired as chief of staff to Teresa Alonzo Leon, who led the charge to successfully defeat the farmers' lobby, who don't lose often in the state legislature. Probably only the timber industries are more successful, putting off very needed legislation. The bill that she won was required farmers to pay overtime to farm workers. Very significant victory, actually. Will surely increase since in harvest times, 10, 12, 14-hour days are very frequent. It will surely increase worker income. How did it come about? What were the factors that allowed that bill to pass?
First of all, you know, Rep. Alonso Leon came here from the state of Michoacan in Mexico with her parents when she was four, and her parents still work in Oregon farms and have worked in Oregon farms for over 40 years. And her district is like the center of Latino farm workers and indigenous farm workers in the state of Oregon, down north of Salem and Woodburn, Jervis. So passing farm worker overtime this session was a big win for her community. And that bill, I'm not an expert in that bill's whole process, but I will give a quick summary from what I feel like I understand. First of all, a few other states have passed farm worker overtime bills in the last few years. They all involve a kind of phase-in period to try to like not hurt various levels of agriculture industry too much, allow them to kind of, you know, basically phase it in. And Oregon's no different. So basically like a bipartisan, bicameral, both houses, the Senate and the House, had a kind of like long task force sort of thing where everyone was kind of sitting down, negotiating, listening to advocates, kind of trying to hammer out a bill that does it right so that you have like justice for workers and a bill that like doesn't harm and doesn't mean to harm the agriculture industry in the state. And that was led by Paul Holvey in the House. And actually for our office, for Rep. Alonso Leon's office, she's the chair of the education committee. So she's like deeply connected with the farm worker organizing organizations who she's worked with for years, getting her into office, doing policy. But are in this very short session, she was really focused, I would say, on like education bills. And she's also in the healthcare committee and some other bills. So it wasn't like our office every day was the spearhead on the farm worker overtime bill, even though she's very like personally connected to that to that policy.
What about the movements? That bill was in play for a number of legislatures. It's been a long time coming. My sense was that, in fact, the movements, you know, on the left, we point out all the time, the way to win things is to, you know, generate movements that politicians can't resist. What do you see as the role of the movements in the farm worker overtime bill?
Well, I mean, I think the movement strength of PICUN and other core organizations that were driving this, I mean, I think they did an incredible job. And one key is that they had a lot of other unions and organizations like brought on board, and they had commitments from them that when push came to shove, when the rubber hit the road, when the Republicans and industry like really turned up the heat against this policy, that when that happened, that these other groups were going to call on their members to actually take action to support the passage of this bill, to support the Democrats staying strong and passing it, to support them and say, if you vote yes on this, if you guys don't back down, like, we'll still have your back come the next election time. Or if the Republicans threaten to walk out and shut down the whole session over farm worker overtime, like, we're not having that. Or we will, you know, we will step out and say something to try to push back on that. And I think the hearings, there were just hours and hours and hours of hearings where you'd have both sides turning out tons of people to testify. You know, you'd have like small blueberry farmers saying, you know, this is going to destroy us and we treat our people well and this law is terrible. No one's listening to us, you know. And there were three times as many people calling up and making the argument that like every other industry deals with times when folks have to work more than usual. And this is what this overtime protection is there for. But definitely, I think the passage of this was riding on the coattails of successes that movements have had in other states, New York, California, Washington, and other states, and also riding on the racial justice movement. That's just like, you heard that argument time and again, that like the lack of farm work overtime is a racist policy and we've got to correct this injustice. And they successfully did pass that law this year, despite nonstop opposition and grandstanding of different forms.
This is Bill Resnick talking to Emory Mark, Chief of Staff of Representative Teresa Alonzo Leon, about the 2022 session of the Oregon Legislature. It passed a great deal of legislation that served working people and also particularly its lowest income people. We discussed how movements can win and how to build power. Emory Mark, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thanks, Bill. I really appreciate it.